Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of May 17th, 2019. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well. How are you, Ted?
Good. So across the country, we have multiple levels of government, right? We have the federal government, which is basically checked out on climate work for the last couple of years. We have state governments, 50 state governments, but of course there are a multiplicity of local governments of all kinds of shapes and forms. And the interesting thing about local government is that they typically are closest to the problems. Sometimes they have the least power to solve the problem, but they are also at the same time closest to the problem. That speaks in many important ways to the climate issue. Local governments can recognize pragmatic things to be done and problems and whatnot. And so that raises a question. The people who run small towns and local governments, how should they be thinking about climate change and what should they be doing about it? So to discuss that topic, we have the good fortune to have with us Mr. Tim Cronin, who works at an organization called Climate Action Business Association here in the Massachusetts area. So, Tim, welcome aboard. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and thank you very much, Ted and Mariah, for having me on. I'm very excited to talk about this issue.
That's great. So, Tim, you heard my sort of lead-in to the concept of what can local elected officials do about climate change? What should they be thinking about? So can you tell me what do you think?
Yeah. So, first off, a little bit about me. I'm the policy and partnerships manager at CABA, but in my free time, and I kind of air quote that for those who are listening, I'm a member of my local energy advisory committee in Weymouth. I'm a lifelong resident. You know, these issues are really close to my heart. And so I think when I first started getting involved with this type of stuff, you know, in climate action, in kind of renewable energy, I didn't think there was much of a role for local electeds. But as I started to get more into the issue, I have to be honest, like local electeds are in some ways right on the front lines when it comes to these climate impacts. You know, and I think it gives them a really important perspective when it comes to dealing with the effects of climate change. But more importantly, it actually gives them a pretty unique sense of urgency around the need to fight for it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something to really consider, and I'm excited to talk about that. So.
And so what kinds of give me sort of like, how should I say, five different categories of local elected officials, right? There's mayors, there's town councilmen, there's selectmen, which all more or less have, right, sort of the governing responsibility for spending money in a town, right? Isn't that the sort of hierarchy?
Yeah. I mean, you got, broadly speaking, you get two things. You get a city and you get a town. You know, towns have selectmen or women and also members of their finance committee and a ton of other boards and whatnot. Sometimes they also have town meetings, you know, whether open or closed. Mm-hmm. You know, cities are a little bit different, more centralized leadership. They have a mayor and an elected town or city council. Sometimes we like to call ourselves town council, even though we are cities. Mm-hmm. But in either one, you know, there are a number of officials who are, you know, in touch with their local residents. They're in touch with those issues that climate is affecting. And, I think they all, if they're being honest with the science, with being honest talking to their residents, you know, do see those effects. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. So what's the, if you're an elected official, give me an example of where climate hits the ground for an elected official. Is it in damage? I mean, because I think, you know, many elected officials are blissfully ignorant, right? You would say that they don't know, they don't want to know because they think it's going to cost them money. I mean, how does that awakening process happen, and how does that work?
Yeah, so I'd say even locally in Massachusetts, what you're seeing with elected officials is the same here as is across the country. You know, as impacts from climate change from the existing carbon that's in the atmosphere are starting to impact things like coastlines and things like, you know, agriculture and whatnot, those tend to seep into the issues that electeds care about. So take, for example, if you're a community on the coast in the South Shore, whether it's Scituate or Cohasset or my hometown of Weymouth, sea level rise was really bad. Not this past winter, luckily, but the winter before that. Mm-hmm. And that's only going to accelerate. And you talk to anyone who's been in the town for a while, and they will usually say, oh, this has not usually happened this much. Mm-hmm. And so that's one way. You know, that sea level rise is like a really poignant kind of symbol of that. But you also have things like inland flooding, you know, longer days of drought. And those things are affect kind of the welfare of citizens and are things that people email or call or even talk to their neighbors in the case of a lot of these local electeds about. But they also have things they have implications for long-term things like finances of the town. I mean, if the tax revenue decreases because, you know, a portion of the town's underwater or people don't move to a town because of perceived threats from climate change, that impacts the ability for them to do their job by providing services. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what's the do you think that those elected officials are, I guess what you're saying is they're driven by the perception of their constituents that things are changing? If you're talking about, as an example, you know, a coastal town in Massachusetts is going to see erosion and damage, they have to respond. Do you think, how does a local official parry the, I mean, I'm sure there's a mindset that if a beach erodes in a town, say, just bring in more sand, dump more sand, right? Just make it the way it was. Don't. I mean, how does a local elected official make the case for climate-friendly changes or policies, I guess?
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, of course, there's definitely local electeds who may not believe in climate change. There's maybe some who are not willing to kind of face the full facts of it. But I think a lot of them do, especially here in Massachusetts. And I think they can make the case in a number of ways. And all of them relate to the fact that, you know, climate change is such a multifaceted issue. So, for example, if you're trying to make, you know, add some solutions that prevent sea level rise from impacting coastal residents or households, you can do things like, you know, include, you know, new open spaces, for example, that prevent flooding. You've seen that in a number of towns. I know Boston as a city is moving forward with plans to try to, you know, increase their resilience, but also by including open spaces there. Another way into the mitigation side of things is tying in the idea of reducing your emissions with saving money broadly. So you can do that through things like, you know, solar panels on town or roofs or in landfills that bring back money, or through things like community choice aggregation, which, you know, has been proven to really decrease the cost for consumers or residents of a town, give them a lot more control of their energy, and in the long run, you know, really provide more towards local renewable energy than, you know, base rates for your electricity. So I think like a lot of elected officials, whether they're mayors or whether they're, you know, sometimes appointed officials or town councilors or select women, you know, they end up being able to kind of tie in all these issues, because no matter what issue you care about, a lot of them have like a pet issue.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do things without money. You can't do things without quality of life broadly. And
well, I mean, how do you think that, what role do elected officials have in mediating, shall we say, the concerns of their constituents up to the state level? Because you're right. I mean, to get the money for a seawall or new solar panels, that probably has to come out of the state. And so what's the give and take there?
Yeah. I mean, so I think it depends on the role here. So I think the first thing is acknowledging that it is an issue, which actually sounds like a really basic thing. But in town forms of government, if you have a board of selectmen and women who aren't acknowledging the issue, that usually doesn't seep into the priorities of things like town managers.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are essentially the mayors of small towns. And they need to be active in pursuing grants and engaging with things like the Mass Municipal Association, which really pushes the legislature on things like this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's close for mayors. You know, as you see like more activism on the local level or whatnot, you know, you see that more willingness from the electeds to kind of pursue that. So grants is one avenue. I think also like continued, you know, looking at municipal budgets and the impacts they can have. I think one of the things I find striking is, at least in Weymouth, we have a seawall in the north on the north coast of Weymouth.
Mm-hmm.
They're up, I think, 10 or 20% of the funding from the state to repair a pretty large section. I think it's almost 700 feet. But the rest of it has to come out of the town's budget. So actually, I'd push back a little bit of the fact that a lot of costs are borne by the town.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on their financial situation, but I think a lot of them have the ability to like find some of the budget, especially if they look at the long-term stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to jump in, I think that there was, David Wallace Wells interviewed Bill McKibben on, I think, on NPR somewhere. I'm not sure where exactly, if it was WBUR, but one of the things that came out of that, Bill McKibben was talking about how 10 years ago, the science and the predictions weren't as firm as they are today. The scientists are more able to say, we can see this happening. This is happening. We know this is happening. And that gives a lot of these town managers and mayors more of a social license to operate and to say, look, here's a really robust scientific report that says we should plan for this and it's worth it. So I don't know if you see that coming down to the local level as much, or if that's more on state level or.
No, I mean, I 100%. I think as like two examples, from the South Shore and from Weymouth specifically. In Weymouth, you know, there was always this broad concept that sea level rise is going to impact a lot of the residents in low-lying areas and along the coast. But I think especially for people who may not immediately think, like, you know, people who are around the water that they're affected, a lot of that data has trickled down to like, okay, look, this area is not a traditional floodplain. That is a concern there. And that data has like allowed them, like you said, they're giving them more social license and explaining it. Another thing is on the South Shore specifically, you know, we go from having, you know, 9 days on average, I believe the statistic is above 90 degrees, to now the predictions are pretty robust around 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks over 90 degrees. And that's like a very poignant, you know, example that these local officials can point to when they're explaining to constituents, like, look, this is why we're dealing with it, because this science is real and this is what it's telling us. And look what happened last summer. We need to deal with it. I think you hit the nail right there on the head in terms of the aspect of data, because, you know, local officials a lot of times are communicators. So.
So tell me this. Weymouth right now is famous for the compressor station, which is, do you think the people in town of Weymouth see that as a climate issue or as a toxic local harm issue? And what's the, I know there's a lot of local leadership there around the compressor station, but how does that fit into the theory of local elected officials and climate change?
Yeah. I mean, I think Weymouth is a unique perspective on this because of that. I think what you see is like we're fighting on the front line of that natural gas infrastructure increasing. I'd say there's what initially created, I think, a big part of the spark for some people was the health, the safety impacts on the community of that. I don't want to say NIMBY because this isn't even a NIMBY issue. This is an issue that is, you know, bigger than a development per se. This is something that impacts people in three cities, over 3,000 students, you know, 950 homes within what is considered the blast radius of this thing. Like, this is a really big health and safety issue. At the same time, I think some of the people who are leading it, especially the president right now, Alice Arena, is someone who believes in fighting climate change to her core.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they have done a really good job because they've created a broad coalition locally of people who are concerned for the safety issues, but also see the issue as broader than that, as fighting climate change, as fighting natural gas. So,
do you think that one leverages to the other? I mean, I can imagine that the and I've seen it happen, that opposition to a particular infrastructure piece, which begins as a threat, sort of the immediate threat to the neighborhood, morphs into a more general appreciation of the impact to the climate of these things, right?
Yeah. I mean, in this project specifically, because as we started to learn more about what the Atlantic Bridge was, mm-hmm. what its intentions were, you know, I think a lot of the multinational oil and gas companies that were proposing it, which for those who might not know, the Atlantic Bridge is a larger project that the compressor station would provide a lot of energy, kind of compression to send natural gas up to Canada. A lot of these companies said that it was to increase gas capacity and decrease costs in the region. But what we found is that might actually, it is not the case. A lot of that natural gas was intended to go to Canada for export as LNG to Europe. And that just
Which is the big lie, if I could interrupt, right? Yeah. That's the big lie, is that all this gas is going to Canada to be exported to Europe, right? And you're just, Weymouth, for example, in the state of Massachusetts, is just passing through, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. We learned about that. And luckily, some of those projects were knocked down. But the Atlantic Bridge, this is a pivotal part of it. If this doesn't pass through, there's no Atlantic Bridge. And if it does, then we have to find another place to fight it. So
tell me this. What's your advice to someone who, I mean, in this age of people becoming more sophisticated and aware about all kinds of issues, what would you say to someone who has both a climate sympathy, but also is interested in being in his or her town government? I mean, what do you tell them? What's the advice?
Yeah, so I mean,
because I hope there's about 150,000 of them listening to this podcast, right? So here's your chance to give them steer them right.
Well, I mean, the first thing is find a local group. So whether it's an MCAN affiliate, 350 affiliate, even like issue groups like CCL, it gets you a foot in the door. What I'd say is almost more important than what a lot of people are recognizing is there's a need to kind of gain power. The best way to gain power is to get involved in the like mechanisms of government. You know, on the baseline, like for example, I'm a member of the Energy Advisory Committee in Weymouth. I did that because I complained about the fact that our roof wasn't solar ready for a new library we did, and they stuck me on it eventually.
But then that's a famous thing, right? You mentioned that all of a sudden you're on the committee. Yeah, okay.
I know, and I was on the committee, and you know, I got to learn a lot. I got to push for a number of things. And you know, that's one way to be involved. I mean, it also comes down to you can, especially in towns, there's a lot of things you can run for that have impacts. Mm-hmm. For example, like health board when it comes to siting of these dangerous, you know, gas infrastructure projects and whatnot.
If I could just jump in, I mean, if MCAN has an example of that, we have recently begun a municipal light, a project to rank and improve, make municipal light plants more green. And it turns out that a lot of people in those towns can run for the municipal light board, right? It's a first step, and it's exactly in the line of what you're talking about, right? Gaining power by running.
Yeah, and even if you don't want to run yourself, you get involved, and I'm sure you can find someone that you can. I heard this, volunteer appoint or whatnot. That's mm-hmm. where this escaping me. You can kind of, you know, help usher someone into running that, and then help them, you know, get in there and make the change that you want to see. So
interesting. Well, we got to put it down there, Tim. Thank you very much. Let me say this. You'll check out the links to most of what we talked about at the blog. We'll put up the link for the CABA USA, the Climate Action Business Association, where Tim works. You can find this podcast on our Facebook page. It's @MassClimateAction. There's a lot of other interesting things there, so please check it out. You can listen to this podcast directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio or any of the major podcast distribution apps, and of course you can find us on Apple Podcast. Please send us a letter telling us what topics we ought to talk about, what problems we have, what you like about the show. Send an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Tim, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Mariah, thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Oh, before I go, I want to say thanks to D.R. Tucker for sending in another, for keeping us honest with all good links. Thanks, D.R. And to everyone listening, we'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Very cool.